my words coming as naturally as breathing to me. I had not intended any flattery or subtle courtship. The sun was beginning to dip into the water, and we sat close by one another, and the beach before us was like the world at our feet. If I had said at that moment, "I would," I think her heart would have tumbled into my awkward hands like ripe fruit from a tree. I think she might have kissed me, and sealed herself to me of her own free will. But I couldn't grasp the immensity of what I suddenly knew I had come to feel for her. It drove the simple truth from my lips, and I sat dumb. And half a moment later, Smithy came, wet and sandy, barreling into us, so that Molly leaped to her feet to save her skirts, and the opportunity was lost forever, blown away like spray on the wind. We stood and stretched, and Molly exclaimed about the time, and I felt all the sudden aches of my healing body. Sitting and letting myself cool down on a chill beach was a stupid thing I certainly wouldn't have done to any horse. I walked Molly home, and there was an awkward moment at her door before she stooped and hugged Smithy goodbye. And then I was alone, save for a curious pup demanding to know why I went so slowly, and insisting he was half-starved and wanting to run and tussle all the way up the hill to the keep. I plodded up the hill, chilled within and without. I returned Smithy to the stables and said good night to Sooty, and then went up to the keep. Galen and his fledglings had already finished their meager meal and left. Most of the keep folk had eaten, and I found myself drifting back to my old haunts. There was always food in the kitchen and company in the watchroom off the kitchen. Men-at-arms came and went there at all hours of the day and night, so cook kept a simmering kettle on the hook, adding water and meat and vegetables as the level went down. Wine and beer and cheese were also there, and the simple company of those who guarded the keep. They had accepted me as one of their own since the first day I'd been given into Burridge's care. So I made myself a simple meal there, not near as scanty as Galen would have provided me, nor yet as ample and rich as I craved. That was Burridge's teaching. I fed myself as I would have an injured animal. And I listened to the casual talk going on around me, focusing myself into the life of the keep as I hadn't for months. I was amazed at all that I had not known because of my total immersion in Galen's teaching. A bride for verity was most of the talk. There was the usual crude soldier's jesting one could expect about such things, as well as a lot of commiseration over his ill luck in having Regal choose his future spouse. That the match would be based on political alliances had never been in question. A prince's hand could not be wasted on something as foolish as his own choice. That had been a great part of the scandal surrounding chivalry's stubborn courtship of Patience. She had come from within the realm, the daughter of one of our nobles, and one already very amicable to the royal family. No political advantage at all had come out of that marriage. But Verity would not be squandered so, especially with the red ships menacing us all along our struggling coastline. And so speculation ran rife. Who would she be? A woman from the near islands to our north in the White Sea? The islands were little more than rocky bits of the earth's bones thrusting up out of the sea, but a series of towers set among them would give us earlier warning of the sea raiders' ventures into our waters. To the southwest of our borders, beyond the rain wilds, where no one ruled, were the Spice Coasts. A princess from there would offer few defensive advantages, but some argued for the rich trading agreements she might bring with her. Days to the south and east, over the sea, were the many big islands where grew the trees that the boat builders yearned for. Could a king and his daughter be found there who would trade her warm winds and soft fruits for a keep in a rocky, ice-boundaried land? What would they ask for a soft southern woman and her tall-timbered island trade? Furs, said some, and grain, said another. And there were the mountain kingdoms at our backs, with their jealous possession of the passes that led into the tundra lands beyond. A princess from there would command warriors of her folk, as well as trade links to the ivory workers and reindeer herders who lived beyond their borders. On the southern border was the pass that led to the headwaters of the great Rain River that meandered through the Rain Wilds. Every soldier among us had heard the old tales of the abandoned treasure temples on the banks of that river, of the tall carved gods who presided still over their holy springs, and of the fake gods that sparkled in the lesser streams. Perhaps a mountain princess, then? Each possibility was debated with far more political savvy and sophistication than Galen would have believed these simple soldiers capable of commanding. I rose from their midst, feeling ashamed of how I had dismissed them. In so short a time, Galen had brought me to think of them as ignorant sword-wielders, men of brawn, with no brain at all. I had lived among them all my life. I should have known better. No, I had known better. But my hunger to set myself higher, to prove beyond doubt my right to that royal magic, had made me willing to accept any nonsense he might choose to present me. Something clicked within me, as if the key piece to a wood puzzle had suddenly slid into place. I had been bribed with the offer of knowledge as another man might have been bribed with coins. I did not think very well of myself as I climbed the stairs to my room. I lay down to sleep with the resolve that I would not let Galen deceive me any longer, nor persuade me to deceive myself. I also resolved most firmly that I would learn the skill no matter how painful or difficult it might be. And so dark and early the next morning, I plunged fully back into my lessons and routine. I attended Galen's every word. I pushed myself to do each exercise, physical or mental, to the extreme of my ability. But as the week, and then the month, wore painfully on, I felt like a dog with his meat suspended just beyond the reach of his jaws. For the others, something was obviously happening. A network of shared thoughts was building between them, a communication that had them turning to one another before they spoke, that let them perform the shared physical exercises as one being. Sullenly, resentfully, they took turns being partnered with me, but from them I felt nothing, and from me they shuddered and pulled back, complaining to Galen that the force I exerted toward them was either like a whisper or a battering ram. I watched in near despair as they danced in pairs, sharing control of one another's muscles, or as one walked blindfolded, the maze of the coals, guided by the eyes of his seated partner. Sometimes I knew I had the skill. I could feel it building within me, unfolding like a growing seed. But it was a thing I could not seem to direct or control. One moment it was within me, booming like a tide against rock cliffs, and the next it was gone, and all within me was dry, deserted sand. At its strength, I could compel August to stand, to bow, to walk. The next, he would stand glaring at me, daring me to contact him at all. And no one seemed able to reach inside me. "Drop your guard! Put down your walls!" Galen would angrily order me as he stood before me, vainly trying to convey to me the simplest direction or suggestion. I felt the barest brush of his skill against me, but I could no more allow him inside my mind than I could stand complacent while a man slid a sword between my ribs. Try as I might to compel myself, I shied from his touch, physical or mental, and the touches of my classmates I could not feel at all. Daily, they advanced, while I watched and struggled to master the barest basics. A day came when August looked at a page, and across the rooftop his partner read it aloud, while another set of two pairs played a chess game in which those who commanded the moves could not physically see the board at all. And Galen was pleased with all of them, save me. Each day he dismissed us after a touch I seldom felt. And each day I was the last free to go, and he coldly reminded me that he wasted his time on a bastard only because the king commanded him to do so. Spring was coming on, and Smithy grown from a puppy to a dog. Sooty dropped her foal while I was at my lessons, a fine filly sired by Verity's stallion. I saw Molly once, and we walked together near wordlessly through the market. There was a new stall set up, with a rough man selling birds and animals, all captured wild and caged by him. He had crows and sparrows and a swallow, and one young fox so weak with worms he could scarcely stand. Death would free him sooner than any buyer, and even if I had had the coin for him, he had reached a state where the worm medicines would only poison him as well as his parasites. It sickened me, and so I stood questing toward the birds with suggestions of how picking at a certain bright bit of metal might unpin the doors of their cages. But Molly thought I stared at the poor beasts themselves, and I felt her grow cooler and farther from me than ever she had been before. As we walked her home, Smithy whined beggingly for her attention, and so won from her a cuddle and a pat before we left. I envied him the ability to whine so well. My own seemed to go unheard. With spring in the air, all in the seaport braced, for soon it would be raiding weather. I ate with the guards every night now, and listened well to all the rumors. Forged ones had become robbers all along our highways, and the stories of their depravities and depredations were all the tavern talk now. As predators, they were more devoid of decency and mercy than any wild animal could be. It was easy to forget they had ever been human, and to hate them with a venom like nothing else. The fear of being forged increased proportionately. Markets carried candy-dipped beads of poison for mothers to give their children in the event the family was captured by raiders. There were rumors that some seacoast villagers had packed up all their belongings in carts and moved inland, forsaking their traditional occupations as fishers and traders to become farmers and hunters away from the threat of the sea. Certainly, the population of beggars within the city was swelling. A forged one came into Buckkeep Town himself and walked the streets as untouchable as a madman as he helped himself to whatever he wanted from the market stalls. Before a second day had passed, he had disappeared, and dark whispers said to watch for his body to wash up on the beach. Other rumors said a wife had been found for Verity among the mountain folk. Some said it was to secure our access to the passes. Others, that we could not afford a potential enemy at our backs when all along our seacoast we must fear the red ships. And there were yet other rumors. No, the barest whispers, too brief and fragmented to be rumors, that all was not well with Prince Verity. Tired and sick, said some, and others sniggered about a nervous and weary bridegroom. A few sneered that he had taken to drink and was only seen by day when his headache was worst. I found my concern over these last rumors to be deeper than I would have expected. None of the royals had ever paid much mind to me, at least not in a personal way. Shrewd saw to my education and comfort, and had long ago bought my loyalty, so that now I was his without even giving thought to any alternative. Regal despised me, and I had long learned to avoid his narrow glance and the casual nudges or furtive shoves that had once been enough to send a smaller boy staggering. But Verity had been kind to me in an absent-minded sort of way, and he loved his dogs and his horses and his hawks in a way I understood. I wanted to see him stand tall and proud at his wedding, and hoped some day to stand behind the throne he would occupy, much as Chade stood behind Shrewd's. I hoped he was well, and yet there was nothing I could do about it if he were not, nor even a way I could see him. Even if we had been keeping the same hours, the circles we moved in were seldom the same. It was not quite full spring when Galen made his announcement. The rest of the keep was making its preparations for Spring Fest. The stalls in the marketplace would be sanded clean and repainted in bright colors, and tree branches would be brought inside and gently forced so that their blossoms and tiny leaves could grace the banquet tables on Spring's Eve. But tender new greens and egg cake with carrot seed toppings were not what Galen had in mind for us, nor puppet shows and hunt dances. Instead, With the coming of the new season, we would be tested, either to be proven worthy or discarded.
Discarded,
he repeated. And if he had been condemning those unchosen to death, the attention of his other students could not have been more intent. I numbly tried to understand in full what it would mean to me when I failed. I had no belief that he would test me fairly, or that I could pass such a test, even if he did.
You shall be a coterie, those of you who prove yourselves. Such a coterie as has never been before, I would think. At the height of Spring Fest, I myself will present you to your king, and he shall see the wonder of what I have wrought. As you have come this far with me, you know I will not be shamed before him, so I myself will test you, and test you to your limits, to be sure that the weapons I place in my king's hand holds an edge worthy of its purpose. One day from now, I will scatter you like seeds in the wind across the kingdom. I have arranged that you will be taken hence by swift horse to your destinations. And there each of you will be left alone. Not one of you will know where any of the others are.
He paused. I think to let each of us feel the tension thrumming through the room. I knew that all the others vibrated in tune, sharing a common emotion, almost a common mind as they received their instruction. I suspected they heard far more than the simple words from Galen's lips. I felt a foreigner there, listening to words in a language whose idiom I could not grasp. I would fail.
Within 2 days of being left, you will be summoned by me. You will be directed who to contact and where. Each of you will receive the information you need to make your way back here. If you have learned and learned well, my coterie will be here and present on Spring's Eve, ready to be presented to the king.
Again, the pause.
Do not think, however, that all you must do is find your way back to Buckkeep by Spring's Eve. You are to be a coterie, not homing pigeons. How you come and in what company will prove to me that you have mastered your skill. Be ready to leave by tomorrow morning.
And then he released us, one by one, again with a touch for each and a word of praise for each. Save me. I stood before him, as open as I could make myself, as vulnerable as I dared to be, and yet the brush of the skill against my mind was less than a touch of the wind. He stared down at me as I looked up at him, and I did not need the skill to feel that he both loathed and despised me. He made a noise of contempt and looked aside, releasing me. I started to go.
Far better,
he said in that cavernous voice of his.
If you had gone over the wall that night, bastard. Far better. Burrich thought I abused you. I was only offering you a way out, as close to an honorable way as you were capable of finding. Go away and die, boy. Or at least, go away. You shame your father's name by existing. By Ida, I do not know how you came to exist. That a man such as your father could fall to such depth as lying with something and letting you become is beyond my mind to imagine.
As always, there was that note of fanaticism in his voice as he spoke of chivalry, and his eyes became almost blank with blind idolatry for him. Almost absent-mindedly, he turned away and walked off. He reached the top of the stairs and then turned, very slowly.
I must ask, he said,
and the venom in his voice was hungry with hatred.
Are you his catamite that he lets you suck strength from him? Is that why he is so possessive of you?
Catamite? I repeated, not knowing the word. He smiled. It made his cadaverous face even more skull-like.
Did you think I hadn't discovered him? Did you think you'd be free to draw on his strength for this test? You won't. Be assured, bastard. You won't.
He turned and went down the steps, leaving me standing there alone on the rooftop. I had no idea what his final words meant, but the strength of his hatred had left me sickened and weak, as if it were a poison he'd put in my blood. I was reminded of the last time all had left me on the tower roof. I felt compelled to walk to the edge of the tower and look down. This corner of the keep did not face the sea, but there were still jagged rocks aplenty at the foot of it. No one would survive that fall. If I could make a decision whose firmness lasted for 1 second, then I could put myself out of it all. And what Burritch or Chade or anyone else might think of it would not be able to trouble me. A distant echo of a whimper. "I'm coming, Smithy," I muttered, and turned away from the edge. 17. The Trial. The man's ceremony is supposed to take place within the moon of a boy's 14th birthday. Not all are honored with it. It requires a man to sponsor and name the candidate, and he must find a dozen other men who concede the boy is worthy and ready. Living among the men-at-arms, I knew of the ceremony, and knew enough of its gravity and selectivity that I never expected to participate in it. For one thing, no one knew my birth date. For another, I had no knowledge of who was a man, let alone if 12 men existed who would find me worthy. But on a certain night, months after I had endured Galen's test, I awoke to find my bed surrounded by robed and hooded figures. Within the dark hoods, I glimpsed the masks of the pillars. No one may speak or write of the ceremony details. This, I think, I may say. As each life was put into my hands, fish, bird, and beast, I chose to release it, not to death, but back to its own free existence. So nothing died at my ceremony, and hence no one feasted. But even in my state of mind at that time, I felt there had been enough blood and death around me to last a lifetime, and I refused to kill with hands or teeth. My man still chose to give me a name, so he could not have been totally displeased. The name is in the old tongue, which has no letters and cannot be written. Nor have I ever found any with whom I chose to share the knowledge of my man-name. But its ancient meaning, I think, I can divulge here. Catalyst. The Changer. I went straight to the stables, to Smithy, and then to Sooty. The distress I felt at the thought of the morrow went from mental to physical, and I stood in Sooty's stall. My head leaned against her withers, and felt queasy. Burridge found me there. I recognized his presence and the steady cadence of his boots as he came down the stable walkway, and then he halted abruptly outside Sooty's stall. I felt him looking in at me.
"Well, now what?" he demanded harshly.
And I heard in his voice how weary he was of both me and my problems. Had I been any less miserable, my pride would have made me draw myself up and declare nothing was wrong. Instead, I muttered into Sooty's coat, "Tomorrow Galen plans to test us."
"I know. He's demanded quite abruptly that I furnish him horses for this idiotic scheme. I would have refused had he not a wax signet from the king giving him authority, and no more do I know than that he wants the horses, so don't ask," he said gruffly, as I looked up suddenly at him.
"I wouldn't," I told him sullenly. "I would prove myself fairly to Galen, or not at all."
"You've no chance of passing this trial he's designed, do you?"
Burridge's tone was casual, but I could hear how he braced himself to be disappointed by my answer. "None," I said flatly, and we were both silent a moment, listening to the finality of that word.
Well?
He cleared his throat and gave his belt a hitch.
Then you'd best get it over with and get back here, then. It's not like you haven't had good luck with your other schooling. A man can't expect to succeed at everything he tries.
He attempted to make my failure at the skill sound as if it were of no consequence.
I suppose not.
Will you take care of Smithy for me while I'm gone?
I will.
He started to turn away, then turned back, almost reluctantly.
How much is that dog going to miss you?
I heard his other question, but tried to avoid it.
I don't know.
I've had to leave him so much during these lessons, I'm afraid he won't miss me at all.
I doubt that, Burrich said ponderously.
He turned away.
I doubt that a very great deal,
he said, as he walked off between the rows of stalls. And I knew that he knew, and was disgusted, not just that Smithy and I shared a bond, but that I refused to admit it. As if admitting it were an option with him, I muttered to Sooty. I bade my animals farewell, trying to convey to Smithy that several meals and nights would pass before he saw me again. He wriggled and fawned and protested that I must take him, that I would need him. He was too big to pick up and hug any more. I sat down and he came into my lap, and I held him. He was so warm and solid, so near and real. For a moment, I felt how right he was, that I would need him to be able to survive this failure. But I reminded myself that he would be here, waiting for me when I returned, and I promised him several days of my time for his sole benefit when I returned. I would take him on a long hunt, such as we had never had time for before. Now, he suggested, and soon, I promised. Then I went back up to the keep to pack a change of clothes and some traveling food. The next morning had much of pomp and drama to it, and very little sense, to my way of thinking. The others to be tested seemed elated. Of the eight of us that were setting out, I was the only one who seemed unimpressed by the restless horses and the eight covered litters. Galen lined us up and blindfolded us, as 60 or more of people looked on. Most of them were related to the students, or friends, or the keep gossips. Galen made a brief speech, ostensibly to us, but telling us what we already knew, that we were to be taken to different locations, and left, that we must cooperate, using the skill, in order to make our ways back to the keep, that if we succeeded, we would become a coterie and serve our king magnificently, and be essential to defeating the Red Ship raiders. The last bit impressed our onlookers, for I heard muttering tongues as I was escorted to my litter and assisted inside. There passed a miserable day and a half for me. The litter swayed, and with no fresh air on my face or scenery to distract me, I soon felt queasy from it. The man guiding the horses had been sworn to silence and kept his word. We paused briefly that night. I was given a meager meal, bread and cheese and water, and then I was reloaded, and the jolting and swaying resumed. At about midday of the following day, the litter halted. Once more I was assisted in dismounting. Not a word was said, and I stood, stiff and headachy, and blindfolded in a strong wind. When I heard the horses leaving, I decided I had reached my destination and reached up to untie my blindfold. Galen had knotted it tightly, and it took me a moment to get it off. I stood on a grassy hillside. My escort was well on his way to a road that wound past the base of the hill, moving swiftly. The grass was tall around my knees, sear from winter, but green at the base. I could see other grassy hills with rocks poking out of their sides, and strips of woodland sheltering at their feet. I shrugged, and turned to get my bearings. It was hilly country, but I could scent the sea and a low tide to the east somewhere. I had a nagging sense that the countryside was familiar. Not that I had been to this particular spot before, but that the lay of the terrain was familiar somehow. I turned, and to the west saw the sentinel. There was no mistaking the double jag of its peak. I had copied over for Fedrin a map less than a year ago, and the creator had chosen the Sentinel's distinctive peak as a motif for the decorative border. So, the sea over there, the Sentinel there, and with a suddenly dipping stomach, I knew where I was. Not too far from Forge. I found myself quickly turning in a circle to survey the surrounding hillside and woodlands and road. No signs of anyone. I quested out almost frantically, but found only birds and small game and one buck who lifted his head and snuffed, wondering what I was. For a moment I felt reassured, until I remembered that the forged ones I had encountered before had been undetected by that sense. I moved down the hill to where several boulders jutted out from its side and sat in their shelter. It was not that the wind was cold, for the day promised spring soon. It was to have something firmly against my back, and to feel that I was not such an outstanding target as I had been atop the hill. I tried to think coolly what to do next. Galen had suggested to us that we should stay quietly where we were deposited, meditating and remaining open in our senses. Sometime in the next 2 days, he should try to contact me. Nothing takes the heart out of a man more than the expectation of failure. I had no belief he would really try to contact me, let alone that I would receive any clear impressions if he did. Nor did I have faith that the drop-off he had chosen for me was a safe location. Without much more thought than that, I rose, again surveyed the area for anyone watching me, then struck out toward the sea smell. If I were where I supposed myself to be, from the shore I should be able to see Antler Island and, on a clear day, possibly Scrim Isle. Even one of those would be enough to tell me how far from Forge I was. As I hiked, I told myself I only wanted to see how long a walk I would have back to Buck Keep. Only a fool would imagine that the forged ones still represented any danger. Surely, winter had put an end to them, or left them too starved and weakened to be a menace to anyone. I gave no credence to the tales of them banding together as cutthroats and thieves. I wasn't afraid. I merely wanted to see where I was. If Galen truly wanted to contact me, location should be no barrier. He had assured us innumerable times that it was the person he reached for, not the place. He could find me as well on the beach as he could on the hilltop. By late afternoon, I stood atop rocky cliffs, looking out to the sea, Antler Island, and a haze that would be Scrim beyond it. I was north of Forge. The coast road home would go right through the ruins of that town. It was not a comforting thought. So now what? By evening, I was back to my hilltop, scrunched down between two of the boulders. I had decided it was as good a place to wait as any. Despite my doubts, I would stay where I had been left until the contact time was up. I ate bread and salt fish, and drank sparingly of my water. My change of clothes included an extra cloak. I wrapped myself in this and sternly rejected all thoughts of making a fire. However small, it would have been a beacon to anyone on the dirt road that passed the hill. I don't think there is anything more cruelly tedious than unremitting nervousness. I tried to meditate, to open myself up to Galen's skill, all the while shivering with cold and refusing to admit that I was scared. The child in me kept imagining dark, ragged figures creeping soundlessly up the hillside around me, forged folk who would beat and kill me for the cloak I wore and the food in my bag. I had cut myself a stick as I made my way back to my hillside, and I gripped it in both hands, but it seemed a poor weapon. Sometimes I dozed despite my fears, but my dreams were always of Galen gloating over my failure as forged ones closed in on me, and I always woke with a start to peer wildly about to see if my nightmares were true. I watched the sunrise through the trees, and then dozed fitfully through the morning. Afternoon brought me a weary sort of peace. I amused myself by questing out toward the wildlife on the hillside. Mice and songbirds were little more than bright sparks of hunger in my mind, and rabbits little more. But a fox was full of lust to find a mate, and farther off, a buck battered the velvet off his antlers as purposefully as any smith at his anvil. Evening was very long. It was surprising just how hard it was for me to accept, as night fell, that I had felt nothing, not the slightest pressure of the skill. Either he hadn't called, or I hadn't heard him. I ate bread and fish in the dark, and told myself it didn't matter. For a time I tried to bolster myself with anger, but my despair was too clammy and dark a thing for anger's flames to overcome. I felt sure Galen had cheated me, but I would never be able to prove it, not even to myself. I would always have to wonder if his contempt for me had been justified. In full darkness, I settled my back against a rock, my stick across my knees, and resolved to sleep. My dreams were muddled and sour. Regal stood over me, and I was a child sleeping in straw again. He laughed and held a knife. Verity shrugged and smiled apologetically at me. Jade turned aside from me, disappointed. Molly smiled at Jade, past me, forgetting I was there. Burridge held me by the shirt front and shook me, telling me to behave like a man, not a beast. But I lay down on straw and an old shirt, chewing at a bone. The meat was very good, and I could think of nothing else. It was very comfortable, until someone opened a stable door and left it ajar. A nasty little wind came creeping across the stable floor to chill me, and I looked up with a growl. I smelled Burridge and ale. Burridge came slowly through the dark with a muttered, "It's all right, Smithy," as he passed me. I put my head down as he began to climb his stairs. Suddenly, there was a shout, and men falling down the stairs. They struggled as they fell. I leaped to my feet, snarling and barking. They landed half atop me. A boot kicked at me, and I seized the leg above it in my teeth and clamped my jaws. I caught more boot and pant than flesh, but he hissed in anger and pain and struck at me. A knife went into my side. I set my teeth harder and held on, snarling around my mouthful. Other dogs had awakened and were barking. The horses were stamping in their stalls. "Boy, boy!" I called for help. I felt him with me, but he didn't come. The intruder kicked me, but I wouldn't let go. Burridge lay in the straw, and I smelled his blood. He did not move. I snarled around the mouthful. I heard old Vixen flinging herself against the door upstairs, trying vainly to get to her master. Again, and then again, the knife plunged into me. I cried out to my boy a last time, and then I could no longer hold on. I was flung off the kicking leg to strike the side of a stall. I was drowning, blood in my mouth and nostrils. Running feet, pain in the dark. I hitched closer to Burridge. I pushed my nose under his hand. He did not move. Voices and light coming, coming, coming. I awoke on a dark hillside, gripping my stick so tightly my hands were numb. Not for a moment did I think it a dream. I couldn't stop feeling the knife between my ribs and tasting the blood in my mouth. Like the refrain of a ghastly song, the memories came again and again, the draught of a cold air, the knife, the boot, the taste of my enemy's blood in my mouth, and the taste of my own blood. I struggled to make sense of what Smithy had seen. Someone had been at the top of Burridge's stairs, waiting for him, someone with a knife, and Burridge had fallen, and Smithy had smelled blood. I stood and gathered my things. Thin and faint was Smithy's warm little presence in my mind, weak, but there. I quested carefully, and then stopped when I felt how much it cost him to acknowledge me. "Still. Be still. I'm coming." I was cold, and my knees shook beneath me, but sweat was slick on my back. Not once did I question what I must do. I strode down the hill to the dirt road. It was a little trade road, a peddler's track, and I knew that if I followed it, it must intersect eventually with the coast road. I would follow it. I would find the coast road. I would get myself home, and if Ida favored me, I would be in time to help Smithy. And Burridge. I strode, refusing to let myself run. A steady march would carry me farther, faster than a mad sprint through the dark. The night was clear, the trail straight. I considered, once, that I was putting an end to any chance of proving I could skill. All I had put into it, time, effort, pain, all wasted. But there was no way I could have sat down and waited another full day for Galen to try to reach me. To open my mind to Galen's possible skill touch, I would have had to clear it of Smithy's tenuous thread. I would not. When it was all put in the balance, the skill was far outweighed by Smithy. And Burridge. Why Burridge? I wondered. Who could hate him enough to ambush him, and right outside his own quarters? As clearly as if I were reporting to Chade, I began to assemble my facts. Someone who knew him well enough to know where he lived. That ruled out some chance offences committed in Buckkeep Town Tavern. Someone who had bought a knife. That ruled out someone who just wanted to give him a beating. The knife had been sharp, and the wielder had known how to use it. I winced again from the memory. Those were the facts. Cautiously, I began to build assumptions upon them. Someone who knew Burridge's habits had a serious grievance against him, serious enough to kill over. My steps slowed suddenly. Why hadn't Smithy been aware of the man up there waiting? Why hadn't Vixen been barking through the door? Slipping past dogs in their own territory bespoke someone well-practiced at stealth. Galen. No. I only wanted it to be Galen. I refused to leap to the conclusion. Physically, Galen was no match for Burridge, and he knew it. Not even with a knife, in the dark, with Burridge half-drunk and surprised. No. Galen might want to. But he wouldn't do it. Not himself. Would he send another? I pondered it, and decided I didn't know. Think some more. Burridge was not a patient man. Galen was the most recent enemy he'd had, but not the only one. Over and over I restacked my facts, trying to reach a solid conclusion. But there simply wasn't enough to build on. Eventually, I came to a stream and drank sparingly. Then I walked again. The woods grew thicker, and the moon was mostly obscured by the trees lining the road. I didn't turn back. I pushed on until my trail flowed into the coast road like a stream feeding a river. I followed it south, and the wider highway gleamed like silver in the moonlight. I walked and pondered the night away, as the first creeping tendrils of dawn began to put colours back into the landscape. I felt incredibly weary, but no less driven. My worry was a burden I couldn't put down. I clutched at the thin thread of warmth that told me Smithy was still alive, and wondered about Burridge. I had no way of knowing how badly he'd been injured. Smithy had smelled his blood, so the knife had scored at least once. And the fall down the staircase? I tried to set the worry aside. I had never considered that Burridge could be injured in such a way, let alone what I would feel about it. I could come up with no name for the feeling. Just hollow, I thought to myself. Hollow. And weary. I ate a bit as I walked and refilled my water skin from a stream. Mid-morning clouded up and rained on me for a bit, only to clear as abruptly by early afternoon. I strode on. I had expected to find some sort of traffic on the coast road, but saw nothing. By late afternoon the coast road had veered close to the cliffs. I could look across a small cove and down into what had been Forge. The peacefulness of it was chilling. No smoke rose from the cottages, no boats rowed in the harbour. I knew my road would take me right through it. I did not relish the idea, but the warm thread of Smithy's life tugged me on. I lifted my head to the scruff of feet against stone. Only the reflexes of Hod's long training saved me. I came about, staff at the ready, and swept around me in a defensive circle that cracked the jaw of the one that was behind me. The others fell back, three others. All forged. Empty as stone. The one I had struck was rolling and yelling on the ground. No one paid him any mind except me. I dealt him another quick jolt to his back. He yelled louder and thrashed about. Even in that situation, my action surprised me. I knew it was wise to make sure a disabled enemy stayed disabled, but I knew I could never have kicked at a howling dog as I did at that man. But fighting these forged ones was like fighting ghosts. I felt no presence from any of them. I had no sense of the pain I'd dealt the injured man, no echoes of his anger or fear. It was like slamming a door, violence without a victim, as I cracked him again, to be sure he would not snatch at me as I leaped over him to clear space in the road. I danced my staff around me, keeping the others at bay. They looked ragged and hungry, but I still felt they could outrun me if I fled. I was already tired, and they were like starving wolves. They'd pursue me until I dropped. One reached too close, and I struck him a glancing blow to the wrist. He dropped a rusty fish knife and clutched his hand to his heart, shrieking over it. Again, the other two paid no mind to the injured one. I danced back. "What do you want?" I demanded of them.
"What do you have?"
one of them said. His voice was rusty and hesitant, as if long unused, and his words lacked any inflection. He moved slowly around me, in a wide circle that kept me turning. Dead men talking, I thought to myself, and couldn't stop the thought from echoing through my mind.
"Nothing,"
I panted, jabbing to keep one from moving any closer. "I don't have anything for you. No money, no food, nothing. I lost all my things back down the road."
"Nothing,"
said the other, and for the first time I realized she had been a woman. Once. Now she was this empty, malevolent puppet, whose dull eyes suddenly lit with avarice as she said,
"Cloak, I want your cloak."
She seemed pleased to have formulated this thought, and it made her careless enough to let me crack her on the shin. She glanced down at the injury as if puzzled, and then continued to limp after me.
"Cloak,"
echoed the other. For a moment they glared at one another in dull realization of their rivalry.
"Me, mine,"
he added.
"No, kill you," she offered calmly.
"Kill you, too,"
she reminded me, and came close again. I swung my staff at her, but she leaped back, and then made a snatch at it as it went by. I turned just in time to whack the one whose wrist I had already damaged. Then I leaped past him and raced down the road. I ran awkwardly, holding onto my staff with one hand as I fought the fastening of my cloak with the other. At last it came undone, and I let it fall from me as I continued to run. The rubberiness in my legs warned me that this was my last gambit, but a few moments later they must have reached it, for I heard angry cries and screams as they quarreled over it. I prayed it would be enough to occupy all four of them and kept running. There was a bend in the road, not much, but enough to take me out of their sight. Still, I kept running, and then trotting as long as I could before I dared to look back. The road shone wide and empty behind me. I pushed myself on, and when I saw a likely spot, I left the road. I found a savagely nasty thicket of brambles, and forced my way into the heart of it. Shaking and exhausted, I crouched down on my heels in the thick of the spiny bushes and strained my ears for any sign of pursuit. I took short sips from my water and tried to calm myself. I had no time for this delay. I had to get back to Buck Keep. But I dared not emerge. it is still inconceivable to me that I fell asleep there. But I did. I came awake gradually. Groggy, I felt sure I was recovering from a severe injury or long illness. My eyes were gummy, my mouth thick and sour. I forced my eyelids open and looked around me in bewilderment. The light was ebbing, and an overcast defeated the moon. My exhaustion had been such that I had leaned over into the thorn bushes and slept, despite a multitude of jabbing prickles. I extricated myself with much difficulty, leaving bits of cloth, hair, and skin behind. I emerged from my hiding place as cautiously as any hunted animal, not only questing as far as my sense would reach, but also snuffing the air and peering all about me. I knew that my questing would not reveal to me any forged ones, but hoped that if any were nearby, the forest animals would have seen them and reacted. But all was quiet. I cautiously emerged onto the road, but it was wide and empty. I looked once at the sky, and then set out for Forge. I stayed close to the edge of the road where the shadows of the trees were thickest. I tried to move both swiftly and silently, and did neither as well as I wanted to. I had stopped thinking of anything except vigilance and my need to get back to Buckkeep. Smithy's life was the barest tendril in my mind. I think the only emotion still active in me was the fear that kept me looking over my shoulder and scanning the woods to either side as I walked. It was full dark when I arrived on the hillside overlooking Forge. For some time I stood looking down on it, seeking for any signs of life. Then I forced myself to walk on. The wind had come up and fitfully granted me moonlight. It was a treacherous boon, as much deceiver as revealer. It made shadows move at the corners of abandoned houses, and cast sudden reflections that glinted like knives from puddles in the street. But no one walked in Forge. The harbour was empty of vessels, no smoke rose from any chimneys. The normal inhabitants had abandoned it not long after that fateful raid, and eventually the forged ones had as well, once there were no more sources of food or comfort there. The town had never really rebuilt itself after the raid, and a long season of winter storms and tides had nearly completed what the red ships had begun. Only the harbour looked almost normal, save for the empty slips. The sea walls still curved out into the bay like protective hands cupping the docks. But there was nothing left to protect. I threaded my way through the desolation that was Forge. My skin prickled as I crept past sagging doors on splintered frames in half-burned buildings. It was a relief to get away from the mouldy smell of the empty cottages and to stand on the wharves overlooking the water. The road went right down to the docks and curved along the cove. A shoulder of roughly worked stone had once protected the road from the greedy sea, but a winter of tides and storms without the intervention of man was breaking it down. Stones were working loose, and the sea's driftwood battering rams, abandoned now by the tide, cluttered the beach below. Once, carts of iron ingots had been hauled down this road to waiting vessels. I walked along the sea wall and saw that what had appeared so permanent from the hill above would withstand perhaps one or two more winter seasons without maintenance before the sea reclaimed it. Overhead, stars shone intermittently through scudding clouds. The evasive moon cloaked and revealed herself as well, occasionally granting me glimpses of the harbour. The shushing of the waves was like the breathing of a drugged giant. It was a night from a dream. And when I looked out over the water, the ghost of a red ship cut across the moor path as it put into Forge Harbour. Her hull was long and sleek, her masts bare of canvas as she came slipping into the harbour. The red of her hull and prow was shiny as fresh spilled blood, as if she cut through runnels of blood instead of salt water. In the dead town behind me, No one raised a shout of warning. I stood like a fool limned on the seawall, shivering at the apparition, until the creak of oars and the silver dripping of water off an oar's edge made the red ship reel. I flung myself flat to the causeway, then slithered off the smooth road surface into the boulders and driftwood cluttered along the seawall. I could not breathe for terror. All my blood was in my head, pounding, and no air was in my lungs. I had to set my head down between my arms and close my eyes to regain control of myself. By then, the small sounds even a stealthy vessel must make came faint but distant across the water to me. A man cleared his throat. An oar rattled in its lock. Something heavy thudded to the deck. I waited for a shout or command to betray that I had been seen, but there was nothing. I lifted my head cautiously, peering through the whitened roots of a driftwood log. All was still, save the ship coming closer and closer as the rowers brought her into harbor. Her oars rose and fell in near silent unison. Soon, I could hear them talking in a language like ours, but so harshly spoken I could barely get the meaning of the words. A man sprang over the side with a line and floundered ashore. He made the ship fast no more than 2 ships' length away from where I lay hidden among the boulders and logs. 2 others sprang out, knives in hands, and scrambled up the seawall. They ran along the road in opposite directions to take up positions as sentries. 1 was on the road almost directly above me. I made myself small and still. I held on to Smithy in my mind the way a child grips a beloved toy as protection against nightmares. I had to get home to him, therefore I must not be discovered. The knowledge that I must do the first somehow made the second seem more possible. Men scrabbled hastily from the ship. Everything about them bespoke familiarity. I could not fathom why they had put in here until I saw them unloading empty water casks. The casks were sent hollowly rolling down the causeway, and I remembered the well I had passed. The part of my mind that belonged to Chade noted how well they knew Forge, to put in almost exactly opposite that well. This was not the first time this ship had stopped here for water.
"Poison the well before you leave," he suggested.
But I had no supplies for anything like that, and no courage to do anything except remain hidden. Others had emerged from the ship and were stretching their legs. I overheard an argument between a woman and a man. He wished permission to light a fire with some of the driftwood, to roast some meat. She forbade it, saying they had not come far enough, and that a fire would be too visible. So they had raided recently, to have fresh meat, and not too far from here. She gave permission for something else that I did not quite understand, until I saw them unload 2 full kegs. Another man came ashore with a whole ham on his shoulder, which he dropped with a meaty slap onto one of the upright kegs. He drew a knife and began to carve off chunks of it, while another man broached the other keg. They would not be leaving any time soon, and if they did light a fire or stay until dawn, my log's shadow would be no hiding place at all. I had to get out of here. Through nests of sand fleas and squiggling piles of seaweed, under and between logs and stones, I dragged my belly through sand and pebbled gravel. I swear that every root snag caught at me, and every shifted slab of stone blocked my way. The tide had changed. The waves broke noisily against the rocks, and the flying spray rode the wind. I was soon soaked. I tried to time my movement with the sound of the breaking waves to hide my small sound in theirs. The rocks were toothed with barnacles, and sand packed the gouges they made in my hands and knees. My staff became an incredible burden, but I would not abandon my only weapon. Long after I could no longer see or hear the raiders, I dared not stand, but crept and huddled still from stone to log. At last, I ventured up onto the road and crawled across it. Once in the shadow of a sagging warehouse, I stood, hugging the wall, and peered about me. All was silent. I dared to step out 2 steps onto the road, but even there I could see nothing of the ship or the sentries. Perhaps that meant they could not see me either. I took a calming breath. I quested after Smithy the way some men pat their pouches to be sure their coin is safe. I found him, but faint and quiet. His mind was like a still pool. "I'm coming," I breathed, fearful of stirring him to any effort, and I set forth again. The wind was relentless, and my salt-wet clothing clung and chafed. I was hungry, cold, and tired. My wet shoes were a misery, but I had no thought of stopping. I trotted like a wolf, my eyes continually shifting, my ears keen for any sound behind me. One moment the road was empty and black before me. In the next, the darkness had turned to men, 2 before me, and when I spun about, another behind me. The slapping waves had covered the sound of their feet, and the dodging moon offered me but glimpses of them. As they closed the distance around me, I set my back to the solid wall of a warehouse, readied my staff, and waited. I watched them come, silent and skulking. I wondered at that. For why did they not raise a shout? Why did not the whole crew come to watch me taken? But these men watched one another as much as they watched me. They did not hunt as a pack, but each hoped the others would die killing me and leave the bounty for the picking forged ones, not raiders. A terrible coldness welled up in me. The least sound of a scuffle would bring the raiders. I was sure. So if the forged ones did not finish me, the raiders would. But when all roads lead to death, there is no point to running down any of them. I would take things as they came. There were 3 of them. One had a knife, but I had a staff and was trained to use it. They were thin, ragged, and at least as hungry as I, and as cold. One, I think, was the woman from the night before. As they closed on me so silently, I guess they were aware of the raiders and feared them as much as I did. It was not good to consider the desperation that would prompt them to still attack me. But in the next breath, I wondered if the forged ones felt desperation or anything else. Perhaps they were too dulled to realize the danger. All of the stealthy, arcane knowledge Chade had given me, all of Hod's brutally elegant strategies for fighting 2 or more opponents, went to the wind, for as the first 2 stepped into my range, I felt the tiny warmth that was Smithy ebbing in my grasp.
"Smithy!"
I whispered, a desperate plea that he somehow stay with me. I all but saw a tail-tip stir in a last effort at a wag. Then the thread snapped, and the spark blinked out. I was alone. A black flood of strength surged through me like a madness. I stepped out, thrust the end of my staff deep into a man's face, drew it quickly back, and continued a swing that went through the woman's lower jaw. Plain wood sheared the lower half of her face away, so forceful was my blow. I whacked her again as she fell, and it was like hitting a netted shark with a fish bat. The third drove into me solidly, thinking, I suppose, to be inside my staff's range. I didn't care. I dropped my stick and grappled with him. He was bony and he stank. I drove him onto his back, and his expelled breath in my face stank of carrion. Fingers and teeth, I tore at him, as far from human as he was. They had kept me from Smithy, and he was dying. I did not care what I did to him as long as it hurt him. He reciprocated. I dragged his face along the cobbles. I pushed my thumb into an eye. He sank his teeth into my wrist and clawed my cheek bloody. And when at last he ceased to fight against my strangling grip, I dragged him to the seawall and threw his body down onto the rocks. I stood, panting, my fists still clenched. I glared toward the raiders, daring them to come. But the night was still, save for the waves and wind and the soft gargling of the woman as she died. Either the raiders had not heard, or they were too concerned with their own stealth to investigate sounds in the night. I waited in the wind for someone to care enough to come and kill me. Nothing stirred. An emptiness washed through me, supplanting my madness. So much death in one night and so little significance, save to me. I left the other broken bodies atop the crumbling seawall for the waves and the gulls to dispose of. I walked away from them. I had felt nothing from them when I killed them. No fear, no anger, no pain, not even despair. They had been things. And as I began my long walk back to Buckkeep, I finally felt nothing from within myself. Perhaps, I thought, forging is a contagion, and I have caught it now. I could not bring myself to care. Little of that journey stands out in my mind now. I walked all the way, cold, tired, and hungry. I encountered no more forged ones, and the few other travelers I saw on that stretch of road were no more anxious than I to speak to a stranger. I thought only of getting back to Buckkeep and Burridge. I reached Buckkeep 2 days into the Springfest celebration. The guards at the gate tried to stop me at first. I looked at them. "It's the Fitz," one gasped. "It was said you were dead."
"Shut up,"
barked the other. He was Gage, long known to me, and he said quickly,
"Burridge has been hurt. He's up to the infirmary, boy."
I nodded and walked past them. In all my years at Buckkeep, I had never been to the infirmary. Burridge and no one else had always treated my childhood illnesses and mishaps. But I knew where it was. I walked unseeing through the knots and gatherings of merrymakers, and suddenly felt as if I were 6 years old and come to Buckkeep for the very first time. I had hung on to Burridge's belt. All that long way from Moon's Eye, with his leg torn and bandaged, but not once had he put me on another's horse, or entrusted my care to another. I pushed myself through the people, with their bells and flowers and sweet cakes, to reach the inner keep. Behind the barracks was a separate building of whitewashed stone. There was no one there, and I walked unchallenged through the antechamber and into the room beyond. There were clean strewing herbs on the floor, and the wide windows let in a flood of spring air and light. But the room still gave me a sense of confinement and illness. This was not a good place for Burridge to be. All the beds were empty, save one. No soldier kept to bed on Springfest days, save that they had to. Burridge lay, eyes closed, in a splash of sunlight on a narrow cot. I had never seen him so still. He had pushed his blankets aside and his chest was swathed in bandages. I went forward quietly and sat down on the floor beside his bed. He was very still, but I could feel him, and the bandages moved with his slow breathing. I took his hand.
"Fitz,"
he said, without opening his eyes. He gripped my hand hard.
"Yes, you're back. You're alive."
"I am. I came straight here as fast as I could." "Oh, Burridge, I feared you were dead."
"I thought you were dead. The others all came back days ago."
He took a ragged breath.
"Of course the bastard left horses with all the others."
"No,"
I reminded him, not letting go of his hand.
"I'm the bastard, remember?"
"Sorry."
He opened his eyes. The white of his left eye was mazed with blood. He tried to smile at me. I could see then that the swelling on the left side of his face was still subsiding.
"So, we look a fine pair. You should poultice that cheek. It's festering. Looks like an animal scratch."
"Forged ones,"
I began, and could not bear to explain more.
I only said softly.
He set me down north of Forge, Burridge.
Anger spasmed his face.
He wouldn't tell me, nor anyone else. I even sent a man to Verity to ask my prince to make him say what he had done with you. I got no answer back. I should kill him.
Let it go, I said, and meant it. I'm back, and alive. I failed his test, but it didn't kill me, and as you told me, there are other things in my life. Burridge shifted slightly in his bed. I could tell it didn't ease him.
Well, he'll be disappointed over that.
He let out a shuddering breath.
I got jumped. Someone with a knife, I don't know who.
How bad?
Not good at my age. A young buck like you would probably just give a shake and go on. Still, he only got the blade into me once. But I fell and struck my head. I was fair senseless for 2 days in fits. Your dog. The stupid, senseless thing, but he killed your dog.
I know.
He died quickly,
Burridge said, as if to be a comfort. I stiffened at the lie.
He died well,
I corrected him.
And if he hadn't, you'd have had that knife in you more than once.
Burridge grew very still.
You were there, weren't you?
He said at last. It was not a question, and there was no mistaking his meaning.
Yes,
I heard myself saying simply.
You were there with the dog that night, instead of trying for the skill?
His voice rose in outrage. Burridge, it wasn't like... He pulled his hand free of mine and turned as far away from me as he could.
Leave me!
Burridge, it wasn't Smithy. I just don't have the skill. So let me have what I do have. Let me be what I am. I don't use this in a bad way. Even without it, I'm good with animals. You forced me to be. If I use it, I can...
Stay out of my stables and stay away from me.
He rolled back to face me, and to my amazement, a single tear tracked his dark cheek.
You failed? No, Fitz. I failed. I was too soft-hearted to beat it out of you at the first sign of it. Raise him well, chivalry said to me. His last command to me. And I failed him. And you. If you hadn't meddled with the wit, Fitz, you'd have been able to learn the skill. Galen would have been able to teach you. No wonder he sent you to Forge.
He paused.
Bastard or no, you could have been a fit son to chivalry. But you threw it all away. For what? A dog? I know what a dog can be to a man. But you don't throw your life over for a...
Not just a dog. I cut in almost harshly.
Smithy, my friend. And it wasn't only him. I gave up the weight and came back for you, thinking you might need me.
Smithy died days ago, I knew that, but I came back for you, thinking you might need me. He was silent so long, I thought he wasn't going to speak to me.
You needn't have, he said quietly. I take care of myself.
And harsher.
You know that. I always have.
And me, I admitted to him. And you've always taken care of me.
And small damn good that did either of us, he said slowly.